Funding for this series is made possible by Biotechnical Communications with a grant from the National Cancer Institute. The following is a special presentation of Journey to Wellness. Journey to Wellness provides health news and information. This broadcast is not intended to replace consultation with a qualified medical professional.
The last time I got on the scale was about a week and a half ago, and I was shocked myself. It said I was 310 pounds.
It's a healthcare crisis with repercussions beyond the numbers on the scale.
I would have to classify obesity as a disease.
Probably 75% of my patient base is diabetic.
Diabetes, cancer, high blood pressure, and other cardiovascular diseases. These are just a few of the conditions that result from obesity. And the problem is growing. The percentage of adult Americans considered obese has doubled in the last 25 years, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
And there's no such thing as big bones. It's a lot of fat on those bones that make it look big.
African Americans are the hardest hit by this trend, especially black women. The American Obesity Association says that over 3/4 of black women are overweight. 51% are obese.
I've tried the Mayo Clinic diet. I've tried Atkins. Quick weight loss.
Dietary choices, physical activity, and cultural mores related to acceptable weight are considered to be contributing factors. And experts agree that it will take multifaceted solutions to break the cycle of obesity in the African American community. Combating obesity, today on Journey to Wellness. Americans are heavier than ever. Over 60% of us are overweight and 1/3 are obese, with the average American gaining 1 to 3 pounds per year since the mid-1980s, according to the CDC. Here in Georgia, the prevalence of overweight and obesity has increased more than 60% in the past 25 years. Beginning in childhood, blacks are more likely than whites to be overweight or obese. Left unchecked, these conditions may soon cause as much preventable disease and death as cigarette smoking, says Dr. David Satcher, president of Morehouse School of Medicine. He began advocating weight control nationally during his term as U.S. Surgeon General in the second Clinton administration.
Obesity kills far more people every year than AIDS. I mean, even when I did my report, which was 2001, we estimated that there were about 300,000 obesity-related deaths in this country every year. And of course, African Americans are disproportionately affected in terms of cardiovascular disease, stroke, cancer, diabetes. All of those things relate to obesity. And so, yeah, we could save far more lives if we could get a handle on this obesity epidemic.
So where do African Americans fit into this health crisis? Black men seem to be keeping pace with other U.S. racial ethnic groups. About 1/3 of all black, white, and Mexican-American men are obese. But for women, these rates diverge. Female obesity rates range from 30% for Caucasians, to 40% for Mexican-Americans, to 50% for African-American women, an important factor in higher rates of chronic disease. Dr. Bill Dietz, director of the Division of Nutrition and Physical Activity at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, explains.
Certainly, the differences in the frequency of obesity in the African American population suggest that women are more vulnerable. The question is whether that vulnerability is a biological vulnerability or a social vulnerability. The same question can be asked about the complications of obesity. We published a study several years ago in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which indicated that when you control for the severity of obesity, the complications don't seem to differ among African Americans, Mexican Americans, and Caucasians. That's not to say that some of these diseases don't occur more often among African Americans. They do. We know that diabetes and particularly, and some elements of cardiovascular disease like elevated blood pressure occur more frequently among African American populations. But when you compare the same degree of obesity in the African American population with Mexican American populations and Caucasian populations, those racial differences seem to disappear, which suggests that one explanation perhaps not the only explanation, but one explanation for those ethnic differences is that obesity is more severe in the African American population.
While obesity rates may vary across racial lines, the reason for weight gain remain the same.
Obesity results from an imbalance of physical activity and dietary intake. We eat more calories than our body uses. People get overweight by eating more calories, more energy, than their bodies use. And that's true across populations. That's true for African Americans, Mexican Americans, Caucasians. The question is, what are the differences across those communities that account for different rates of obesity? And that's a lot less certain.
Defining the cutoff point for obesity can also be challenging, with some consumer advocates arguing that rates are inflated to open the market for fat-busting pharmaceutical products. But most in the medical field rely on the body mass index, or BMI, to measure body composition. The ratio of height to weight can be used to estimate one's percentage of body fat, creating an index from healthy weight to severe or class 3 obesity. For adults, a BMI of 25 or greater is considered overweight or obese. Although this number may vary for athletes who typically have a high muscle mass or for the elderly who generally have less muscle mass. Calculate your body mass index online at wabe.org. Click on Journey to Wellness. Waistlines can also be used as a guide to determining health risks. Men with measurements of 40 inches or more and women with waists measuring 35 inches or more and BMIs of 25 or higher are at increased risks of developing type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and hypertension, according to the American Obesity Association.
The real challenge for us is trying to understand why these differences exist. My own suspicion is that these cultures are quite different with respect to food intake, physical activity, and body image. Unless we understand those differences, and unless we understand how to address those differences, I don't think we're going to be successful at controlling this epidemic.
Obesity is also known to increase the risk for 9 cancers, including cancers of the colon, breast, uterus, kidney, esophagus, pancreas, gallbladder, liver, and the top of the stomach. A high body mass index also makes it difficult to detect tumors. Excess weight may account for 14 to 20% of cancer deaths, according to the American Society for Clinical Oncology. African Americans top all other U.S. racial ethnic groups when it comes to cancer deaths. Dr. Terry Mason chairs the National Black Leadership Initiative on Cancer for the Midwestern section of the country.
We're supposed to have disparity.
He attributes black cancer rates to obesity and history.
How can you look back at the history of African Americans in this country and expect that we're supposed to be where the majority population is supposed to be? If you do that and come out with that as your analysis, something is wrong with you. You cannot expect the people where it was just a little over 50 years ago that we were granted the right to have, at least granted the right for equal education. That in 1964, we were just given the right to vote, totally given the Equal Rights Amendment was signed in 1964. I mean, so how can you expect a people who just in the last 50 years of this country, over 400 years of history, to be equal with the people that have been here all along? That's insane. So disparities exist because they're supposed to. We're supposed to be disparate because of what the history of this country has been. And racism in this country is why we have disparities, period.
African Americans typically have higher bone density than whites, leading some to attribute their higher than average weight to their skeletal system. Dr. Mason is outspoken about the untruth of this belief.
There's no fat skeletons. So this whole idea of having big bones is crap, and we should forget about it. It doesn't make sense. I don't even know where it came from. It's crazy. There's no such thing as big bones. So what it's big, it's a lot of fat on those bones that make it look big, but it has nothing to do with big bones. Has never made anybody overweight. So we are in a situation now that people are having their anatomy altered in order to lose weight because the foods that we're eating don't allow us to have the control enough over ourselves to stop eating them. and we're as big as 2 to 3 people now.
Nachos aren't bad, but it's got chili on it. And it says meaty chili, and then sausage on it.
There are decisions to be made while reviewing the menu at an Athens, Georgia theme restaurant.
My cousin would like to have the grilled chicken Caesar salad.
Literally hundreds of food items to choose from, some with greater health benefits than others.
My name is Tiffany McKay Gordon. I'm a native of Athens, Georgia. Just turned 33 years old. Office manager at the University of Georgia in the Division of Academic Enhancement. And I completed a Bachelor's of Arts in Sociology with a Political Science minor, and I'm applying to the Master's of Social Work program at the University of Georgia. I enjoy people. I'm a socializer. I love the plan. I love life. I love my family. That's what's most important to me. And I love to eat, which is why I'm in the situation I'm in.
Tiffany is 5'6", and she weighs over 300 pounds. And this is the situation she finds herself in. According to Dr. Dietz, race may have a lot to do with the image Tiffany sees when she looks in the mirror.
There is some research which shows that African-American women perceive their bodies quite differently than Caucasian women. African-American women tend to not see weight, increased body weight, as a personal failure. That in the African-American culture, based on what we've learned over the years, how a woman dresses and how she carries herself seem much more important than how much she weighs. In addition, one of the characteristics of African-American women is that the frequency of eating disorders is much lower, suggesting that perceptions around food are quite different. And one of the most important challenges that I think we face is, how do we make weight a health issue for the African-American woman without creating the neurosis around food intake that now exists among Caucasian women?
This might be a misconception of mine. I know that I'm heavy and yeah, I'm fat to a certain degree, and I'm obese medically, that's the medical term, but I don't feel like I'm obese because I'm still mobile. Only thing I can't really do is probably run for run half a mile. I can't run, but I can do anything else I want to do.
Tiffany says being obese doesn't cramp her social style.
It hadn't hindered me from catching any men. Unfortunately, I think I used my weight as a security blanket. I feel like if a guy can accept me for who I am, and for the, you know, not that I look sloppy or anything, but for me being heavy set, then they're probably partially a decent person.
Nor does she believe she's been hit with any of the diseases associated with overweight and obesity. But with a body mass index of 50 and a family history that includes heart attacks, diabetes, high blood pressure, and strokes, Tiffany is gambling that these conditions won't catch up with her. But once every hour, an African American loses this bet and dies from the complications of high blood pressure. Known as the silent killer, hypertension can lead to heart attack, stroke, or kidney failure. Stress, fear, and certain medications can cause blood pressure to rise temporarily. However, hypertension, or resting blood pressure of 140 over 90 or above, is caused when the small blood vessels that branch off from the arteries become constricted, making it difficult for the blood to pass. The heart has to work overtime to keep the blood flowing. Some hypertensive patients may experience headaches or lightheadedness. Many others have no symptoms until it's too late.
There's so many people here in the U.S. That have high blood pressure and don't realize that they have high blood pressure.
Christopher Fitzpatrick is the CEO of the International Society on Hypertension in Blacks.
And if you don't know it, then you're not making changes in terms of your lifestyle, in terms of your eating habits, in terms of not exercising and doing those things, those preventive type things that would go along in terms of controlling your blood pressure.
The society estimates that 1/3 of African Americans have high blood pressure. And 20% of these don't know that they have the condition. While high blood pressure commonly begins after age 35 in the overall U.S. population, the rates for blacks begin to escalate in early adulthood. 32% of African American men over 20 have high blood pressure, along with 38% of their female counterparts. In 2003, the International Society on Hypertension in Blacks established guidelines for treating high blood pressure in African Americans. First, the organization says blacks should strive for a lower blood pressure target, under 130 over 80, instead of the standard 140 over 90. The recommendations for blacks also include combination drug therapy, that is, two or more medications to lower blood pressure. And African Americans with diabetes should receive medications to slow the progression of kidney disease as part of their medication regimen.
If we don't provide treatment and education early on in a person's life, then what happens in terms of the complications as we grow older?
Many of these complications have a hefty price tag associated with them.
In 1999, the Lewin group did a study and indicated that the direct health cost of obesity in 1999 was $102 billion, a little bit over $102 billion.
Today, the CDC estimates that obesity costs $75 billion a year in medical expenses. Half of it is funded by taxpayers through Medicare and Medicaid. Fitzpatrick says this is one area of the budget we can all work to reduce.
We all have to be responsible for our health, and that there are things that we can do to prevent various diseases. And if we have those diseases, then we can not just take the medication, but we can make changes in our lives and cut down in terms of the overall health cost associated with these diseases.
Shedding just 5 to 10 pounds can go a long way towards reducing your risk for hypertension, heart disease, diabetes, and cancer. Learn more online at wave.org. Click on Journey to Wellness. When Journey to Wellness continues,
lobbying for diabetes, especially this Bill 83, it would gut everything.
Diabetes patients head to the state capitol to lobby lawmakers to continue insurance coverage for the screening and testing supplies they say are vital to controlling this disease. Faced with a potential shortfall of tens of millions of dollars in the community health budget, the Georgia legislature is attempting to move more patients into managed care plans, a strategy that may save money and cost lives, say some diabetes advocates. Carol Snipe Crawford served as executive director of the State Office of Minority Health. Now she's using her experience in state government to teach diabetics to serve as citizen lobbyists.
The group that's here today is here to express a concern and opposition to House Bill 83, which is an insurance bill that would attempt to establish the options for insurers to offer policies that don't have mandated benefits. And the bottom line of that means that many of the things that are key to risk reduction in the community and key to early intervention, the management tools that diabetics would require, would not be covered items and available to them through their health insurance policies if this bill were to pass.
The Small Business Employee Choice Benefits Health Insurance Plan Act. It's a long name for a bill that would allow companies with 15 employees or less to provide fewer health benefits than usually mandated by the state. A cost savings for small businesses, but a potential liability for employees with chronic illnesses like diabetes.
My name is Elizabeth Graham. I've been a diabetic for 12 years. It's a disease that you have to every day. It's a new surprise. It's debilitating. It's life-threatening. You can lose anything at any given moment. You get a bump. If it's not healed properly, it could turn into a sore. You could lose a limb. You could lose your eyes. If your blood sugar is too high, you could have a stroke.
A long family history with the disease has taught Elizabeth Graham the realities of diabetes.
I just recently had a brother that 2 weeks ago we buried him. He was a diabetic and he had a massive heart attack. So I've had this disease. It's disease in my family, my mother, my sisters, one brother. I had a sister that died with one leg. She had bumped her ankle, and she wound up having to have a leg cut off at the ankle up to her thigh. And that was complications that she died from, complication of diabetes. My mother had complication from diabetes. She died. So I'm having to be very careful. It took me a long time to really dawn for it to sink into my head that this is, anything could happen to me at any time. And it's really not a wonderful thing to have to be a diabetic. You know, it takes to have to walk in somebody's shoes to know that you could lose anything at any time. I have to go to eye clinic because they have to constantly check my eyes to see if glaucoma, my grandfather had glaucoma. So it's always something you have to be very careful about. And for as African Americans, we really don't take it seriously. And a lot of people are dying.
She says more people will die if they have to pay out of pocket for the testing supplies they need to monitor their blood sugar levels.
Every morning, stick yourself to test your blood, take a shot, and throughout the day, test your blood sugar. In the afternoon, take a shot. You got to have a special diet. You got to have special shoes. You got to exercise. You could go blind from glaucoma. You could lose a limb. It's just something every day, and it's for the rest of your life.
About 2.7 million blacks over the age of 20 have diabetes. However, about one-third of them don't know it. Dr. Guillermo Impieres, director of diabetes and endocrinology at Grady Hospital in Atlanta, says hundreds of patients are admitted each year when the complications of undiagnosed diabetes overwhelm them.
At Grady Hospital, we receive approximately 350 patients admitted every year in this crisis. These are acutely ill patients. We have designed several protocols how to treat them. Our treatment is quite effective, but it's very costly. They are admitted to the hospital with weight loss and symptoms of nausea, vomiting, have been urinating severely for the last 2 to 4 weeks. Unfortunately, hyperglycemic crisis is more common in African Americans and other minority populations compared to Caucasians. Of all the patients admitted with high blood glucose and the severe hyperglycemia or high blood glucose, approximately 17% of them have new onset diabetes. So they didn't know that they were diabetics, and they just have been diagnosed when they come to the hospital. Some of them have infections or other precipitating causes. But a large number of patients that we have in our institution, and the same occurs all around the country in inner city patients, minority patients, is that for whatever reason, they stop taking the insulin. And more than half of the patients are admitted repeatedly because they stop taking the insulin therapy.
Diabetes is a condition in which the pancreas cannot make enough insulin, or the body cannot process the insulin it produces. Insulin is important because it helps get glucose from food into our cells, creating energy. With diabetes, the sugar in foods builds up in the blood instead of being used for energy. African Americans are 1.6 times more likely to have diabetes than whites. According to Dr. Umpieres, this has little to do with race.
Obesity is the number one risk factor for the development of diabetes in all races, especially in African Americans and minority populations where the rate of obesity is higher. The rate of diabetes in minority population is about twice as high as in Caucasians. Approximately more than 50-60% of our populations in this country is overweight after the age of 45. Diabetes is more prevalent after the age of 40-50 years of age. There is a direct correlation between obesity and diabetes.
Like many urban areas across the country, Metro Atlanta has seen a marked increase in at least one type of diabetes, which is impacting children in particular.
There are two types of diabetes. One is called type 1 and the other is called type 2. Taiwan is produced by some chemicals in the body that destroy the pancreas. We call these chemicals antibodies. So there are substances that are usually occurs in childhood after a viral infection in some patients who have genetic predisposition. And these chemicals go and destroy the pancreas. At the end, the pancreas do not make any insulin, and they usually present in children. However, there are some adults that also present with type 1 diabetes. The other type of diabetes is type 2. This is a disease that we used to call it adult onset. However, right now in the world, the number of type 2 in children has increased significantly. In some areas of the United States, Texas, downtown Atlanta, downtown Memphis, and Alabama, Mississippi, the number of children with type 2 have surpassed the number of children with type 1 diabetes. Unfortunately, the reason why this is happening is because of the tremendous increase in obesity, sedentary life in our children. In the future, we expect that type 1 diabetes will continue to have more or less the same number of cases. But if we don't detect, if we don't prevent the progression of obesity in this country, the number of type 2 diabetes in children would be all over the country.
To prevent complications from diabetes, patients need to control their blood pressure, cholesterol, and glucose levels. But Dr. Impiera says his experience has taught him to go beyond these interventions.
It is quite important that we also think outside the glucose box and think about the cholesterol and the blood pressure. So it's very costly to take, each one of our patients take 3, 4, 5, 6 different medications. Around the nation, $1 out of $7 spent in health care is spent on diabetes care. So 15% of the total budget of health care is for diabetes care. A very prevalent, a very costly, a very serious disease.
I might get some hot fingers just so you can try them.
Back at the restaurant, Tiffany Gordon is close to selecting an item from the menu. She says experiencing some of the symptoms of diabetes hasn't been enough to cause her to begin losing weight.
In a test, it does not show that I have diabetes completely, full-blown diabetes. But I'm experiencing some of the symptoms of diabetes. Frequent urination. The constantly feeling dehydrated, not having enough water in your system. Last time I checked, I was borderline for diabetes. So I didn't have my blood pressure and sugar and all that stuff has always been really good.
I think we might be ready. And I think the hostess said that you guys had a prime rib for a $9.99 small one. What all comes with that?
House salad
or what now?
And one side.
Oh, okay. Let me go with the... What are the steamed vegetables that are steamed?
Cauliflower.
Ugh.
Tiffany will skip the vegetables today, as she says she does quite frequently when she eats out.
Well, I live by myself. I don't really have time to cook. So, when I do cook, I'll cook like a lean cuisine dinner of some sort. And I cook the frozen ones, the skillet sensations or whatever. And I might cook like stuff that you don't want to buy frozen, like corn or peas or butter beans or something like that. And soup and stuff like that. But I don't really cook. I might go weeks without cooking.
Restaurant meals, frozen dinners, and fast food are frequently high in fat and sodium, as is much of the soul food enjoyed by many African-American families. But a Sunday dinner doesn't have to be unhealthy. The Body and Soul program of the National Cancer Institute sponsors healthy eating workshops at churches. One Saturday at Providence Baptist Church, the menu includes collard greens, cornbread, sweet potatoes, and fried chicken, all prepared with a nutritious twist. Chef Al Bridges, owner of Chanterelle's restaurant in Atlanta's West End, lowers his voice when he explains how he began cooking healthy soul food.
To be honest with you, I'm a vegetarian.
Chef Bridges became a vegetarian 20 years ago when he was plagued with digestive problems. He hasn't looked back.
Then I said, hey, when I started feeling better, I wanted to keep on feeling better. So I just stuck with what made me feel better. So that was one of the things that, you know, kind of inspired me to, you know, have it available for people that wanted to eat healthy, too. Because I don't cook with any meat. I don't serve pork in the restaurant. I don't have anything fried in the restaurant. Okay? So it's, you know, it's just my daily routine. It's just a part of life for me.
I'm here because I did not get to choose my genetic background, and I would like to find out more ways that I could prepare the food that my family likes, but do it in a healthy manner.
That's Latrinka Riley. As lunch begins at the Body and Soul Seminar, she doesn't seem to miss the fat and salt that Chef Bridges left out.
I like the oven-fried chicken. I was pleased that it looked just like it would have if I were going to pan-fry it. I was expecting to see maybe cornflakes or something, and that's not really good. So I really did like the chicken. The greens are excellent.
When it comes to creating his recipes, Chef Bridges has a few simple principles.
Some of the things, just like if you have vegetables, like you do carrots, onion, celery, garlic, you know, you can do lemon juice and stuff instead of salt. You know, most people don't really know that, but you don't have to put salt on your chicken or fish or anything. You get fresh lemon, take it, you can grate it, use the zest and the juice and put over it and stuff and bake it up, and it tastes just like it got salt on it. When I showed you, you know, the fried chicken, instead of doing it, deep frying it, I baked it in the oven, and I did not put any oil on it. I used Pam, you know, on it and sprayed it a little bit, but as far as using oil and fat and stuff like that, no, you don't have to do that. Same thing if you're going to do fish. If I'm going to do baked fish, then I'm just going to do lemon, pepper, and I'm going to just take breadcrumbs, you know, something like that, and then I'm going to use maybe some Pam or something and spray it and put it in the oven and bake it.
Links to recipes for tasty dishes that will keep you healthy are available online at wabe.org.
I do a lot of focus on diabetes. Probably 75% of my patient base is diabetic.
Dr. Miriam Burnett is the director of the Faith in the City program at the Interdenominational Theological Center in Atlanta. A physician and minister, she says churches can provide nurturing environments which serve to improve African American health.
God's temple is our bodies, and we have to find a way of conveying that to people in a way that does not make them feel belittled. You cannot empower somebody to act correctly for their own good if they are feeling belittled because they don't feel like there's a way that they'll win anyway. The other thing we do is with diabetes, we have those church dinners, and if a diabetic really and truly wants to stick to their diet, they can't come to the meeting.
Okay, I'm big bone, so what?
Dr. Gary Gibbons, director of the Cardiovascular Research Institute at Morehouse School of Medicine, on the challenges to getting blacks to view overweight and obesity as serious conditions.
And so one of the difficulties is not everyone who's obese has high blood pressure. Not everyone who's obese will get diabetes. Not everyone who's obese will have a stroke. You've increased your risk. And from a standpoint of clinicians and research, the best thing would be if we could identify the highest risk group. And so one of the markers of future events are changes in the functions of the blood vessels. And so there are research type tests that can be done to say how healthy is your blood vessel? Does it dilate and function the way it's supposed to? And there's a relationship between the sickness of the function and or dysfunction and future cardiovascular events. And so one of the studies that we've done is to look at vascular function in otherwise healthy African-American women who didn't have any other diseases they were aware of. And we observed that many of them had very sick blood vessels, the dysfunctional blood vessels, and that correlated quite closely with their obesity.
At Morehouse School of Medicine, Dr. Gibbons and his colleagues are researching the relationship between obesity and changes in the blood vessels. Changes that can cause hardening of the arteries, coronary heart disease, heart attack, stroke, and hypertension. All conditions that disproportionately impact African Americans.
They're fairly striking changes in the blood vessels that come before you're symptomatic or even before your doctor would say you're sick or we need to give you medicines. And those are early changes, and we're trying to understand that at a sort of basic fundamental level. And one of the things that we're observing in the from the basic science standpoint, is obesity can be characterized as really a what's called a pro-inflammatory state. So everybody's used to what happens with a cold and their body's defense is coming up. Well, in a sense, when you're obese, it's as though your body is stressed in fighting off something. So a lot of the hormones and things that come with fighting off an infection are actually activated when you're overweight. And we've learned that the fat actually produces substances that can be detrimental to the blood vessels and promote vascular disease. So that's particularly problematic amongst people of lower socioeconomic status. And we hypothesize can be particularly problematic amongst racial ethnic groups that suffer from racial discrimination.
Retaining fat in times of stress may have served a purpose in ancient times, but Dr. Gibbons says modern life has eliminated that need.
The body, when it is under duress and stress, secretes a number of hormones that probably were helpful to us when we were in the jungle running from that tiger and healing and responding appropriately. But in, you know, westernized society, tends to just build up hormones that actually affect how fat is stored. And so, in a sense, it may have been helpful to, after a stressor, to have some mechanisms that will pack away the energy in storage for another day as you got chased away from the food. But it again, in this society where we have excess calories, that kind of mechanism can predispose to obesity, and it also, those same hormones tend to damage the blood vessels. So now that we live so much longer, if you chronically are exposed to those hormones and cytokines, you predispose to vascular complications and heart disease. And so part of the challenge is obviously to reduce obesity by being more active and watching your food intake. And what we're learning is that even just weight loss of 5 to 10 pounds reduces those markers of stress within the body. And so part of the salutary effects of weight loss, it's not just that you look good and your clothes fit better, but a lot of those deleterious factors that are hurting the blood vessels actually are reduced. And that may be part of the protective function that people are seeing.
Dr. Gibbons says, lose the weight and the blood vessels just might repair themselves.
We can see dysfunction, but some of that dysfunction is reversible. So to the degree to which you undergo a lifestyle change, some of those things can become normalized. And indeed, that's one of the endpoints of the study that we're doing, is to track how those abnormalities can improve by these, you know, lifestyle changes that are healthy. So, you know, a lot of it comes back to, you know, what your grandmother told you to do in terms of, you know, getting some fresh air, walking, eating right, fresh fruits and vegetables. A lot of those things actually have factors in them that help the body deal with the stress and all these inflammatory factors. So we're now documenting that in a, you know, modern techniques of molecular biology and physiology.
Dr. Gibbons also recommends that those who are preparing to make weight loss lifestyle changes take baby steps.
Often people think it's as such a daunting task that I have to lose 15 pounds and I have to run in the marathon next month. It's really a matter of a gradual lifestyle change that's sustainable. And so the idea here is to move in stepwise fashion. And so just moving off the couch and starting to walk 30 minutes, first a few times a week and then maybe perhaps every day, and getting that increased fitness is actually already contributing to reducing your risk. And in that way, by becoming more fit, you're reducing your risk. You'll also find, parenthetically, that as you do those activities, you'll find it much easier to lose the weight and keep the weight off, because obviously you're now affecting metabolism and you're able to deal with those excess calories more effectively. So they go really hand in hand. But the idea is it's not a matter of just dieting and fasting and this fat diet to that fat diet. It's a lifestyle that includes both activity and moderation.
Check it out.
According to the CDC, 15% of children between 6 and 11 are overweight, putting these youngsters at risk for health problems such as diabetes, heart disease, and high blood pressure. Obese toddlers have a 20% chance of growing up to be obese adults. If they keep the weight on into adolescence, that likelihood climbs to 80%. The answers to reversing this trend may begin before the first spoonful of baby food.
Breastfeeding has been clearly associated with decreasing the risk of obesity long term.
Pediatrician Dr. Terry McFadden, Medical Director of Ambulatory Pediatrics at Hugh Spalding Children's Hospital. She treats a high number of overweight children and recommends breastfeeding to protect children from excess weight gain.
We don't really understand why that is. It may be that breastfed babies learn to feed on demand, and so they learn to recognize the clues and the signs of hunger a lot better than children who are fed bottles and fed on schedules. That's one theory. But it's not really clear why it is that breastfed babies are leaner, but they are over the long term, and they tend to have fewer problems with obesity in childhood. I would have to classify obesity as a disease. The problem with obesity is that we have some long-term effects. We have high blood pressure, we have diabetes, we have the psychological effects that we don't really talk a lot about, self-esteem in young children, which can lead to depression later in adolescence. So there are lots of long-term consequences of the disease of obesity.
Beyond breastfeeding, genetics and lifestyle are key factors in childhood obesity.
Heredity plays a big role, however. The studies that have been done show that if you have one parent who's obese, you have about a threefold increase in your propensity to be overweight. If you have two parents who are obese, you have about a tenfold propensity to be obese. So the cards are definitely stacked when you have an obese parent. But heredity is not the only factor. Clearly, lifestyle is important. Diet is very important. Exercise is very important. Black children, minority children, and children who live in impoverished areas, urban children, tend to be at higher risk for obesity from the start. Often there's not safe play areas, so those children can't go out and run around and ride their bicycles. Parents are afraid to allow them out. Urban children often live in areas where there are not big grocery stores that have good produce. So those children tend to eat more processed foods. So I think the food guide pyramid, the revisions, are really trying to reach out to all Americans, no matter if you're urban or rural, and try to bring everybody to the same level in terms of taking in the appropriate whole grains, cutting back on fats, and incorporating exercise as well.
About 30% of Georgia middle and high school students are overweight, with Black and Hispanic students having the highest rates of overweight and obesity.
That means that we've got to start with our children.
Dr. David Satcher, president of Morehouse School of Medicine.
So I'm spending a lot of my time now in programs related to childhood obesity, including the Action for Healthy Kids program. I don't know if you've heard about it, but we started that program in October of 2002. We now have volunteers all over the country working trying to get the schools to return to requiring physical education K-12, working to try to get the schools to get rid of vending machines that have high-calorie, high-fat foods in them. So the same schools that no longer require physical education K-12 are feeding children things that would increase the likelihood that they would be fat. So we're trying to change that, but also working with parents, trying to emphasize the importance of helping children to develop lifetime habits of good nutrition and physical activity.
The CDC has launched the VERB program to encourage minority children to engage in physical fitness. Dr. McFadden says she's been challenged by the prospect of getting kids involved in weight loss.
I have struggled with this over the years, just trying to figure out what the best approach is with children. And what I have arrived at is that having open-ended questions to the child, directing open-ended questions to the child about their feelings about
how they look or how they feel or how they what their exercise tolerance is like is really revealing, because we often as healthcare professionals sit and want to talk and tell and show. And sometimes we learn more by listening to our patients and hearing what they feel and what they're going through. I think the children that I've been most successful in helping to change their weight have been the ones that I have approached by saying, tell me, how does this make you feel? And it's a very emotionally charged issue, even for some of the younger children, because children are teased, their self-image is low, and they are looking for ways to improve their body image, but they need some help from adults.
Now 310 pounds, Tiffany Gordon says that her weight problems began very early.
I've always been overweight, from what I understand, from maybe the fifth grade on up. I guess I've been obese since probably high school, for sure. I say about the 10th grade. I think that was the last time I weighed about 160-something.
Tiffany says she developed her eating habits largely because her mother rarely cooked.
When she did, it was horrible. So I ate a lot of canned stuff like Chef D meals and Hamburger Helper and whatever else I wanted to eat.
These habits caused her to put on even more weight once she left home.
I know that when I was a freshman in college, I think I gained about 35 pounds the first year. That's because I was eating hamburgers and french fries at every meal just about. I went crazy. I was eating myself to death. Literally, I guess.
According to Dr. McFadden, weight maintenance varies between individuals, but good health should be the goal.
You may not agree with the absolute end point in terms of where you should be, but I think most of us would not argue that the earlier that we catch problems in terms of patients, children or adults being overweight, the easier it is to impact that. So it's a lot easier to lose 5 or 10 pounds than it is to lose 40. And so I think we don't want to become fixated on the absolute end point. And we could argue about bone structure and who deposits fat more easily. I mean, there's some indication that in an effort to ward off starvation, that some African descendants actually store fat a little more easily than others. That's not really clear. I think what is clear is that even small amounts of weight loss, if you're morbidly overweight or overweight by 30 pounds or so, can achieve really good results in terms of your blood lipid profiles and your general sense of well-being and energy. So again, we might not want to quibble about absolute endpoints, but I think we do want to help people get to a healthier lifestyle. Being model thin is not the goal. That's not the goal, but being in a healthy range. And even people who are not losing weight in large amounts can have wonderful benefits from exercising. Perhaps the goal should be more of being in shape and attaining good cardiovascular health, and not as much focusing on absolute weights.
At the International Medical Clinics in Atlanta, doctors are investigating whether chelation therapy, the addition of an amino acid to the blood, can effectively treat heart disease. The subjects of this study are men and women aged 50 and over who have had a heart attack. In conjunction with the National Institutes of Health and over 100 medical institutions across the country, the IMC team will add a man-made amino acid called EDTA to the blood of a test group over a 28-month period. Control subjects will receive a placebo. The study will measure whether the treatment reduces the incidence of stroke and future heart attacks. Physician Lisa Merritt also uses medical interventions to minimize fat deposits in some patients.
For localized fat deposits, like
let's say a protuberant belly or a little that people call the saddlebags on the sides of the thighs. Those are areas of fat storage patterns. We can actually inject small quantities of certain medications in those areas, which will accelerate the process of lipolysis, which is fat breakdown. And that is augmented by exercise. And people will actually see that they will lose circumference, lose inches in those areas, and they will see those areas smoothing out as they go through the treatment protocol. But this is not a magic bullet that you get one shot and boom, you're going to lose 30 pounds. Anybody that's promoting that, run away from them. It doesn't work like that. This is a gradual treatment that's going to take anywhere from 5 to 10, or in some cases even 15 treatments, usually given weekly, sometimes spaced further apart. What mesotherapy consists of is a specialized injection technique of small quantities of specific formulations of medications in specific areas. What's eloquent about it is it allows you to use the skin as like a time-release deposition for the medication. You can bypass giving things by mouth, which then have to be metabolized through the gut and the liver and the kidneys, and having possible systemic side effects, and having to give larger doses of medicines. What's also beautiful about it is that it's something that you tie with an overall wellness program, because it only will work to the extent that the patient will support the treatment. And that gives you a chance to really help motivate people, because as part of their wellness program, we talk about dietary changes, reducing fat, increasing the fruits and vegetables to 3 servings each a day, reducing the amount of carbohydrate, increasing the aerobic exercise to 30 minutes at least a day. These kind of things, they're going to maximize the benefits of the therapy. The best candidates are usually the people who are exercising, who are committed to a wellness plan, where they're really trying to make a lifestyle change. They want to eat better. They want to be fit. They want to smooth down certain areas. They may have some cellulite. They may have some local fat areas that they just can't get rid of. If somebody's trying to lose 50 pounds and they're just very large and they're pretty sedentary, this is not the place to start. A lot of people have this mindset of wanting to put the answer to their obesity problem outside of themselves. And the challenge that we have is to stop being so passive, to become active about our own healing, about our own wellness, and stop thinking in terms of, well, if somebody could just cut it out, or somebody could just suck it out, somebody could just give me a pill, or somebody could just give me a shot. None of those are really the ideal solution. The ideal solution is to eat less, to eat breakfast, because it's going to be metabolized better, to eat small, frequent meals throughout the day to avoid the development of hunger and then the tendency to overeat later in the day, to eat less fat, to eat more fiber. I mean, it's really not that complicated.
Tiffany Gordon may not agree with that assessment. She says diet and exercise have not been successful in helping her lose weight.
I tried about a year ago when I was going to California, and I did lose the weight. I walked twice a week for 35 minutes a week, and it wasn't bad. The only thing that I didn't do was change my eating diet. That was the only thing I didn't do. And I lost weight. It was a slow loss, though. And then as soon as I stopped walking and stuff, the weight, of course, came back on. So I know that if I really, really was stuck to the guns, I could lose the weight. But I don't know if I have that much willpower to do it, because I was hungry during that time. And I don't like to be hungry. It's uncomfortable.
27-year-old Kelly McCrory has had mixed results with her weight loss plans.
I've tried the Mayo Clinic diet. I've tried Atkins. Quick weight loss. I lost about 24 pounds doing that in maybe 3 months. I first joined Weight Watchers, I would say maybe about 3 or 4 years ago. It was pretty good. I lost maybe about 20 pounds.
But then Kelly dropped out of the program.
I kind of got tried to count. So, you know, I fell off the bandwagon. And, you know, I've tried other diets or whatever, but, I mean, they work. Anything works if you, you know, stick to it. But I decided to go back. I think that 2005 is my year. I like to really stick with it and really lose weight.
One of the things I said I always wanted to do is I do want to know what it feels like to be smaller, but I don't want to be skinny. And skinny to me is 150 and less.
With the meal coming to an end, Tiffany Gordon is reflecting on what a lifetime of obesity has meant to her.
And what I've come to realize is that I eat for comfort. Not only for that, but just because I like the taste of food. But I think my obesity more so not is attributed to the food, but the lack of exercise. Because I really don't ever exercise. I mean, I started about a year ago, but exercise is not something that excites me. So it's something new to me.
Almost 30 years ago, Chandra Russell's circumstances were similar. Today, everything has changed for the founder of the Afrobics Exercise Program.
I'm in my early 50s, and I have 5 grandchildren, and I've been exercising since I was in my 20s. And prior to that, I was very overweight and very stressed out. So over the years, throughout my years, I have been working out. I enjoy yoga and power walking as well.
For the past 15 years, Chandra has helped men and women of all ages get excited about fitness on the dance floor.
I decided that it would be really great to have an exercise technique combining African and Caribbean moves in a more simplistic form to increase the awareness of fitness, to get everybody up and moving, and to just have a different way of working out, because I know that high blood pressure, heart disease, cancer, they're all in our community, in the African American community. So I am committed to being more in the community to get us moving, and Afrobic is my vehicle, is my way of doing that.
In order to regain control of our weight and enjoy overall wellness, former U.S. Surgeon General Dr. David Satcher prescribes the following. Moderate physical activity at least 5 days a week, 30 minutes per day, and physical education for all school children. Eat at least 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day and make low-fat whole grain foods available on school campuses as well. Reduce time watching television or in other sedentary activities. Educate all expectant parents about the benefits of breastfeeding. Avoid tobacco, illicit drugs, and abuse of alcohol. And change the perception of obesity so that health becomes the primary concern, not personal appearance. As with any lifestyle change, take it slowly and be sure to discuss your plans with your healthcare provider. I'm Nwandi Lawson, wishing you continued success on your journey to wellness.
Executive producer Lois Reitzes, program producer Nwandi Lawson, medical content advisor Dr. Mary Harris. For information about controlling obesity and associated illnesses, call the American Dietetic Association Consumer Nutrition Information Hotline at 1-800-366-1655. You can access this program on demand, along with extended interviews, supplementary health resources, and relevant links online at wabe.org. For Atlanta Forum, I'm Leah Fleming. Good night.